This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Alaska. The dreams of Alaska. I learned from Charlotte Howard at The Economist, the executive editor, that Alaska has been a blank sheet for people to write their dreams on for many decades, many centuries. But right now, it's important to define what next for Alaska. We begin with my first understanding of Alaska, which was in the 1970s, 1980s, because I knew people who were talking in New York about going on off to Alaska to build the Trans-Alaskan Pipeline, the TAPS, because there was a discovery like gold in Alaska, 10 billion barrels of oil. Well, that was then, and this is now. Charlotte, a very good evening to you. The discovery of gas, of oil, in the North Slope of Alaska led to a bounty for the people of Alaska. I believe for some years, maybe it still continues, they were getting a check every year if you were an Alaskan citizen. And that changed the political environment. It also changed the environment today. In your recent trip to Alaska, do you see the damage or the environmental leftovers of that early exploitation of Alaska's riches? Good evening to you.
Thanks for having me. It was really a remarkable boom that began in the late 70s once that pipeline that stretched all the way across Alaska is 800 miles from the North Slope all the way down to the Port of Valdez. When that was completed in 1977, what came after was this huge bounty for Alaska. And you're right that there was a sovereign wealth fund that was created to help manage the oil wealth. And there was a dividend that was created to go to Alaskans each year. And that dividend is still paid in a bluer state than Alaska. You might think of it as universal basic income. But that still is very much part of Alaskan political life and Alaska's fiscal situation. And so you see now, you know, the oil industry over the past several decades since that boom began in the late 1970s, it really has had quite a remarkable decline since the late 80s. So production peaked in the late 80s, and now it's about 80% below its level then. That doesn't mean, however, that Alaska isn't still extremely dependent on oil revenue. The damage done, you ask about the environmental damage done, there has been decades of fighting over oil and how and where it should be developed within Alaska, and those fights continue to this day.
Yes, we're looking at the North Slope, and the scale here is daunting to express. It's just big. It's very, very big. This is the North Slope, and the development, and there's a map accompanying Charlotte's story in the Economist, so you can imagine it yourself. There is the NPRA, that's the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, and that's along the North Slope. And in the development here, oil was what was originally extracted. That's what everybody went there for. And I learned that in 2000, it was a wilderness area where explorers were still living there rough. But here today, it's been transformed into people living, what you'd have to say, sort of like on a space colony. At the same time, there's this other development that's going on, almost as another theme entirely, or as you write, Charlotte, another way, another lens to look at Alaska, and that is Arctic amplification. What is that? What does it mean, and what does it look like in the North Slope?
So Arctic amplification is not confined to Alaska, but it's a phenomenon across the Arctic. So one of the reasons why Alaska is so fascinating is because it raises these questions of what happens in a state that's dependent on oil as those oil resources begin to decline. So you mentioned NPRA, which is this area the size of Indiana, where there actually hasn't been much oil development to date, but there now is hope for a revival of Alaska's oil industry by starting to drill within NPRA. It's just to the west of where most of Alaska's development to date has been, in Prudhoe Bay. But as you think about the future of oil in Alaska, there's this parallel thing going on, which is that the climate change is of course, continuing apace. And we think of climate change as something that happens in kind of a linear fashion, but it really does not. Arctic amplification is a term that scientists use to describe a phenomenon, which is as follows, that as sea ice melts, the ocean absorbs more sunlight. There's not sea ice to reflect that sunlight back up into space. And those warmer oceans then accelerate warming more broadly. So it's kind of this vicious cycle. And scientists have known about Arctic amplification for a long time, but the pace at which it's happening continues to be pretty surprising. So it was just in August that there was a new paper published in a peer-reviewed journal that estimates that Arctic temperatures have risen at roughly four times the global average since 1979. So there's this really accelerated climate change that's happening within the Arctic and within Alaska.
Now we have two tracks here. One is the extractive services in general. The other is the environmental observations of the changes globally, but especially now we're looking at the sea ice and the Arctic itself, the permafrost, the ecosystems. And what is striking is, I learned from Charlotte that oil peaked on the Trans-Alaskan pipeline in 1988 at 21 million barrels a day. It's been declining ever since, so much so that when the Congress in, I believe the date is 2017, here in the 21st century, vouchsafed again exploring the North Slope or extracting more oil from the reserves in the North Slope that had been forbidden for many years or prevented for many years, that there were no major oil companies bidding. Why is that, Charlotte? Are they discouraged? Is it too expensive? Why didn't the big guys move in the way they did in the 20th century?
Well, it's a really interesting question. A lot of things have changed since late 1977. And I just want to quickly correct you. The TAPS had 2.1 million barrels of oil a day back in 1988.
I left the point out of my notes. Thank you. 2.1, right.
not to be a stickler, but the big things that have changed since the 1970s are as follows. One is that banks are concerned about climate risk and about litigation risk. So the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is just not that appealing to many financers of big oil projects. It's not seen as particularly promising. And that points to the second phenomenon that's changed since the 1970s, which is that this enormous resource has been further developed within the lower 48 states in the form of shale oil and shale gas. So before, people thought in the late 1970s, there was this wide consensus that really American oil production might have peaked in the late 70s and might continue a precipitous decline forever. And fracking technology really changed that. And so when you're fracking in the Permian Basin in West Texas, for instance, it's a pretty quick project. You can have a project up and running much, much, much more quickly than you can in Arctic Alaska. And those reliable returns for most investors just seemed more appealing than bidding on a highly contentious piece of land in the Arctic.
Yes, the contentious part, the politics of this now weigh on the decisions to be made in the 21st century. Let's go to Anchorage, Alaska, where I learn it is a city not unlike Peoria, Illinois. Now, that wouldn't have occurred to me, but it has to do with the metropolitan area and the population. Is the people of Anchorage, are they aware that the environment today is a major concern globally, not just in Alaska, not just in New York City? And are they aware that the old days are gone? Did they talk about it, Charlotte?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of diversity of opinion within Alaska. There are people who are profoundly passionate conservationists. There are also many in Anchorage who think that Alaska should be able to develop its natural resources the same way that every other state has been able to develop its natural resources. So the argument from the likes of the governor, Mike Dunleavy, who I spoke with as part of this reporting, is that it's not fair for those outside of Alaska to treat the state like some magic nirvana that needs to be saved. That's elitist and hypocritical. The oil has to come from somewhere. Why not develop it within the United States rather than relying on an oil producer in the Middle East or in Russia? And so that's a very strong, strongly held view by many in Alaska, that there are people outside the state who meddle in the state's affairs and that Alaska should be left to do what it does best, which is develop its resources, and they argue in a way that's as environmentally sustainable as possible. So that's the argument from the pro-oil camp within Alaska.
Well, here's what makes me pause about that, because you introduced to to me, these wonderful dreams of the past where Alaska's environment was ignored entirely. For example, I mean, these are amazing. They were going to build, they proposed to build a dam, the Army Corps of Engineers, that would have created a lake the size of what? Lake Erie, the Rampart Dam. Or they were going to use nuclear weapons, atomic bombs, in something called the Project Plowshare to create a harbor, a new harbor. In other words, Alaska was seen, you can throw anything you want up there. There aren't many people. Let's take advantage of it. And that's what makes me pause about these ideas of the moment. And let's talk about your trip to the reaches where, what'd you say, that the closest human settlement, it was 80 miles or 180 miles to the west. What is the permafrost? What is happening to it, Charlotte?
So the permafrost is a term that's used to describe the broad swaths of soil that are permanently frozen, that don't thaw and then refreeze each year. And the permafrost spans about 85% of Alaska, and in some places it's very thin, and in other places it might be hundreds of meters thick. And the reason why scientists care about the permafrost is because it is an absolutely enormous carbon sink. So it stores much more carbon than across the Arctic than currently exists in the atmosphere. And the problem is that the permafrost is starting to thaw. And so as it thaws, microbes start, you know, doing their thing and munching on soil, and they emit greenhouse gases, including methane, which is a very damaging greenhouse gas. And so there's this risk that as permafrost continues to thaw, that what had been a carbon sink for millennia turns into a carbon source. And that permafrost, those permafrost emissions to date have not really been properly accounted for in what are called carbon budgets, which is the amount of carbon the world can continue to emit while remaining within a certain bound to try to restrain the most damaging impacts of climate change. And so this question of what's happening with the permafrost, how quickly it's thawing, how we might slow that transition from being a carbon sink to being a carbon source is of enormous interest to scientists and should be of interest to all of us in thinking about the pace of climate change going forward.
I think I also learned from you, I've always known that the native peoples in Alaska, the indigenous peoples, have many words for ice, whereas we go with ice. Okay. Is the ice changing? Is that the climate, Charlotte, what you can see and what they talk about, the new kind of ice when it forms?
Yeah, so so much of life across the Arctic depends on different patterns of ice. There's the breakup each spring, which is a big event. So when different waters become passable. But sea ice absolutely is changing, and this is observed both anecdotally, but absolutely also borne out by data. There's scientists at the International Arctic Research Center, which is in Fairbanks, Alaska, who has done a study, and he's looked at records dating back from the beginning of the industrial age. He and his colleagues pieced together all sorts of interesting pieces of data, even whaling logbooks, you know, meteorological reports from Danes from Finland, stretching all the way from the late 19th century through 2017 or 2018, I can't recall the exact end date, but their findings show that the sea ice, the summer sea ice in the Arctic, has shrunk by about 12% a decade since 1979.
Right.
And the reason they looked so far back is because they needed to show that that had never happened in the industrial age prior.
I'm speaking with Charlotte Howard, executive editor of The Economist magazine, upon her reporting of the North Slope of Alaska, then and now. When we come back, a place called Willow, the ambitions of ConocoPhillips, and the question of what is to be done. A comment from a mayor of a town on the North Slope tells the story. Quote, "Our life, health, and safety should not be the cost of oil and gas development and national energy needs." This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.